This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says an agreement on reviving the 2015 deal hinges upon the settlement of safeguards issues between Tehran and the IAEA. The Pentagon says it's accelerating production of high-mobility rocket systems, or HIMARS, supplied into Ukraine. British teachers and charities warned that widespread hunger will be the biggest challenge facing the schools in England. Children are getting ready to return to classrooms. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The top story, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi says that an agreement on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal depends on the settlement of safeguards issues between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Raisi says it makes no sense to talk about reviving the deal without settling those issues. The IAEA recently asked Iran to provide explanation for what are called traces of enriched uranium at some of its undeclared sites. Tehran has urged the agency to abandon politically motivated allegations often coming from the Israeli regime. In a presser in Tehran, Raisi also called on the signatories to honor obligations under the 2015 accord. The pact hit a snag when former U.S. President Donald Trump walked out of it and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Tehran and other parties have been in talks to revive the deal for more than a year. Tehran is now reviewing the U.S. response to a recent EU draft proposal aimed at reviving the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The United States is accelerating production of high-mobility rocket systems, HIMARS, to supply them to Ukraine to help it fight Russia, and that according to a senior Pentagon official. William LaPlante made the comment after visiting Lockheed Martin, a key U.S. arms manufacturing company. He added that Washington's goal is to help Ukraine defend itself against the Russian aggression. Lockheed Martin tweeted that it takes pride in delivering products that enable America's mission success. On Wednesday, President Joe Biden also announced that he is sending an additional $3 billion in military aid to Ukraine. The latest package pushes the total amount of military assistance Washington has offered to Kiev since February to nearly $14 billion. Russia has repeatedly warned that arming Ukraine adds fuel to the fire and prolongs the war. The International Atomic Energy Agency chief is leading a delegation to Ukraine to inspect a Zaporizhia nuclear plant that's now in control of Russian forces. In a tweet, Rafael Grossi said that the IAEA's support and assistance mission would arrive at Europe's largest nuclear power plant later this week. He also posted a photograph showing him and a team of 13 people on their way to Ukraine. Grossi has for months been asking for permission, warning of a nuclear disaster risk amid reports of repeated shelling of the plant. The Zaporizhia site was taken by Russian troops shortly after they launched an offensive in Ukraine late in February. Moscow and Kiev have traded blame for shelling around the complex in a UN Security Council meeting. Last week, Russia's envoy confirmed that an IAEA mission will visit the site. He said Moscow would extend maximum support possible to resolve all organizational issues. Gas and electricity prices have risen to historic highs in Italy, with businesses complaining energy bills have gone up 10 times compared to last year. As Max Schill reports from Rome, thousands of Italian businesses risk going bankrupt in the coming months.
Italy's energy crisis keeps getting more worrying by the day as wholesale gas prices have surged to skyrocketing levels. Italy, like most of its European neighbors, has reviewed its energy strategy following the start of the war in Ukraine and the sanctions against Russia, Rome's largest gas supplier, accounting for over 40% of imports. In an attempt to diversify its gas supplies, Rome has sealed new deals with Algeria and has planned the construction of new gas infrastructures, a move that includes buying more LNG and setting up new regasification plants.
Italy relies on fossil gas for 40% of its electricity production, with the consequence that electricity costs have gone crazy. Our industrial system relies very much on gas-produced electricity. The risk is that the products of our steelmakers and of our manufacturers will soon be out of the market.
Italy's industrial lobby Confindustria has warned of the risk of widespread company failures if energy prices keep surging this way. Confindustria is calling on the government to create a plan for rationing gas and to provide new subsidies to shield manufacturers. Gas prices have recently climbed to over 320 euros per megawatt hour, three times the price recorded at the beginning of July and about 1,000% more compared to the same period a year ago. Businesses have slammed the rate as unsustainable, while consumer groups have described it as an emergency.
The impact on the average Italian will be dramatic. I expect a profound reshape of our lives and energy future.
In less than a month, Italy will return to the polls with a large number of electors expected to skip the vote. According to latest polls, 16 million Italians, accounting for 35% of Italy's 51 million voters, will not cast their ballot as, quote, the trust in politician is wearing thin. Max Civili, Rome.
I've got looking at the UK now, children getting ready to return to schools, teachers and charities warning that widespread hunger will be the single biggest challenge facing schools. The challenge has led to calls for the government to introduce universal free school meals. Charities are angry that the threshold for free school meals has not changed since 2018, despite soaring inflation. According to charity group, 800,000 children living in poverty in England miss out on free school meals despite the cost of living struggles of families. Now, that number is expected to rise. Schools are also facing other challenges. The president of the National Association of Head Teachers says that some schools may have problems to keep the lights on. The new revelation comes amid reports that inflation in the UK is already at a 40-year high of more than 10%. A huge relief operation is underway in Pakistan following rain-triggered floods that devastated the whole country last week. The government has already declared national emergency and deployed the army to help in rescue and aid efforts. Army helicopters are struggling to pick people from mountains north to safety. National Disaster Management Authority has reported 28 more deaths, pushing the figure to more than 1,060 since June. Last week, historic rains devastated four main provinces, with Balochistan being the hardest hit. The floods have destroyed more than 2 million acres of crops, thousands of kilometers of roads, and dozens of bridges. Over 33 million people have been affected. Officials say that this year's floods are the worst on record. The government has appealed for international help to deal with the disaster. Afghans are marking 1 year since a U.S. Airstrike that killed 10 children, including 10 civilians, that is, including 7 children. The attack took place amid Washington's messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and the end of its 20-year military campaign in that country. A correspondent reports from Kabul.
The final act of terror by the U.S. before ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan was targeting a civilian car with a missile and killing 10 members of a family last year. 2-year-old Somaya was the youngest, and 6 other victims were under 18. 3 adults were also among the fatalities. This deadly strike took place by the U.S. forces amid their evacuation following the Taliban's return to power.
We heard a very terrifying sound. We were running like crazy to get there. We saw a car burning in fire. People were killed. There was a lot of smoke and people were screaming. The U.S. said there was ISIS in that house, but later they confessed they were all civilians.
So, were there others killed? Yes.
U.S. officials tried so hard not to utter the word civilians at first, but later they confessed that the strike was a mere mistake, taking the lives of 10 innocent people.
And acknowledge our mistakes.
The last memory from U.S. presence in Afghanistan is the drone strike that killed 7 children. During their presence, the Americans conducted thousands of similar operations, killing countless civilians. They use this attack to turn the media away from their shameful pullout. They do such actions by breaking legal and international standards. This was a war crime, and the perpetrators should have been tried.
According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, More than 900 civilians have been killed in the U.S. airstrikes since 2015 in Afghanistan. And so far, no one has been held accountable. The drone strike that took the lives of 7 children and 3 adults showed once more that the victims of the U.S. missions are mostly innocent civilians. Abdullah Amirzadeh from Kabul.
Israeli forces have kidnapped a young Palestinian man after wounding him during a raid in the occupied West Bank town of Gabatia, south of Jenin. The regime forces encircled the house of Ala Zakarna and forced his family to leave before storming it and rounding him up. At least 10 more people sustained injuries after troops fired live rounds at local youths and resistance fighters protesting the raid. One person who was shot in the back is said to be in critical condition. Zakarna is a member of Al-Quds Brigades, an armed wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement. Media has reported clashes in different parts of the West Bank in response to the latest Israeli raid. The lawyer of a Palestinian inmate who has been on hunger strike for around 6 months says that he is now in a terribly difficult health condition. 40-year-old Khalil Awada, the father of 4 children, has been refusing food for 169 days in protest at his detention without charge by Israel. Lawyer says that he is suffering from serious weight loss and has difficulty speaking due to his prolonged hunger strike. Awada was supposed to be released by Israel last month. However, the regime reneged on his promise to put an end to its so-called administrative detention. Awada has been arrested 5 times since 2005 for political activism. He has been placed under administrative detention 3 times ever since. More than 680 Palestinians are being held by Israel without any charge or trial. They're denied access to basic rights such as medical care and are frequently subjected to systematic torture. Syria has urged the United Nations and the Security Council to explicitly condemn Israel's air raids on its territory. In our news review program a short while ago, we discussed the world body's failure to stop Israel's frequent acts of aggression against the Arab country.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Syria has called on the UN and the Security Council to issue a clear and explicit condemnation of Israeli aggressions on its territory. In a letter addressing the UN chief and the head of the Security Council, the Syrian Foreign Ministry recalled some of recent Israeli crimes, including an attack on the Damascus International Airport last June. It said the attack caused the airport to go completely out of service for 2 weeks. The ministry noted that the regime is determined today more than ever to sabotage Syria's infrastructure and to endanger the lives of civilians. It said Israeli aggressions are a direct threat to regional and international peace and security, adding that Damascus reserves the right to respond to the attacks. Israel frequently carries out missile strikes in Syria. The latest one came last Thursday when Israeli jets targeted a research facility in the city of Mustaya. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali joins us from Damascus to tell us more about the story. Paul Rabudi joins us. He's a Syria Solidarity Movement who joins us from Berkeley. Okay, Muhammad Ali, first over to you. We're looking at how Syria has made its claim in the Security Council once again about these strikes coming from Israel, and also now for the past few days, at least, the U.S. has also led that that march with strikes within Syrian territory. What kind of response has the U.N. given either to what Syria has claimed today or in previous times when it made its case?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't heard of any response from the United Nations with regards to the letters, tens of letters actually sent by the Syrian Foreign Ministry almost every time Israel carries out an attack on Syria, undermining its sovereignty and sometimes killing or injuring civilians and causing material damage to public and private property. We haven't heard any international condemnation from the international community or from the United Nations with regards to such attacks. And even though in all letters the Syrian government asks the United Nations to shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security, it's not that there's no action being taken against Israel to stop it from carrying out such attacks, but also there has been almost no condemnation with that regard. Now, the Syrian government knows that as a fact, that perhaps it might not get any result from such letters. However, what it wants to say is that it will not keep silent about that, because being silent over such aggressions would encourage Israel to continue with its attacks. And this is why every time the Syrian government makes it clear to express its stance of condemnation over such attacks, and that those attacks do really harm the security of the region as a whole, because those attacks, when Israel carries out such attacks, it does not just undermine Syria's sovereignty, it also endangers civilian flights, it violates Lebanese airspace when it attacks Syria most of the times also.
Well, last time we checked there, Paul Rudy, we don't believe Israel is at war with Syria, nor the U.S., but you have U.S. occupying Syrian soil, and you have Israel obviously repeatedly attacking Syria. And the U.S. also, just in the past days, too, have done the same in terms of carrying out airstrikes. What kind of thinking is there in the U.N. when it sees this and yet it doesn't do anything? Because, as our correspondent said, and it takes pure logic to see that this really creates instability, and it could go into another phase which would maybe just take the region as a whole.
Well, there are members of the UN that really don't mind insecurity and feel that the more of it, the better. Those members specifically are the United States and Israel. And Israel does this to make the United States feel that it is a necessary accessory to U.S. crimes. A valuable ally, if you will, in the commission of crimes to increase the insecurity in the region, and this is something that we can expect to go on, because there is no defense to it. But as Muhammad Ali said, this is for the Syrian government to essentially go on the record, because suppose that the United Nations Security Council even brings this up in conference, which I imagine they probably will do, but it's going to be vetoed by the United States. So nothing is really going to happen. There's going to be no condemnation from the United Nations unless it's from the General Assembly, which has no teeth behind it.
Okay, thank you for that. Paul Rudy, Syria Solidarity Movement from Berkeley. Muhammad Ali, thank you so much, a correspondent there from Damascus. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests,
with the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh, I slept a lot. I have to get up. Time for breakfast and a new beautiful summer day in Kashan. Thank God I can make tea in an old Iranian teapot and samovar here. Hi, Mom. I'm fine, thanks. Actually, I've resided in the famous Amiriha house. For today, I'm going to visit the traditional bazaar of Kashan. Thank you. Bye-bye. The historical Kashan Bazaar is one of the must-see attractions of the city of Kashan and also one of the most significant traditional bazaars of Iran that will amaze visitors with its artistic architecture and nostalgic atmosphere. Just like other traditional bazaars of Iran that are considered as the main elements of the city's old texture, the roofed Kashan Bazaar is surrounded with other historical monuments of the city like old mosques, caravanserais, abambar or water cisterns, covering an area known as the city's old district. This bazaar dates back to the Buyid and Seljuqid eras. It started booming during the Safavid era, and what is remained is a bazaar which is built on the remains of the old bazaar during the Qajarid era. This bazaar is registered in Iran National Heritage List. Time to go. Yes, I'm going to visit the Bazaar of Kashan today. but I'm afraid it's not possible to visit the entire bazaar in just half a day. Kashan is a very special city, full of old stunning sights. So here it is. Good. Not a long way to go. Oh God. Look at the city. I'm crazy about these Adobe-made walls. This city looks like a history book. I'm excited to visit this bazaar. It said this bazaar has been one of the most important trade centers of the past until today. Well, I am now at the traditional bazaar of Kashan. Wow. Just from the entrance of this bazaar, you can guess this market is an Iranian Islamic architectural masterpiece. The architecture and main structure of this bazaar looks like all bazaars of Iran. This bazaar constitutes different sections like Raste, Sara, Timche, and Chahar Sogh. I am now in Mianchal Chahar Sogh. Well, it has old wooden gates. You may not believe, but this Chahar Sogh is one of the most beautiful sections of this market. Here I am in Aminodole Timche. This part of the bazaar is the old section of the bazaar. The entrance of Aminodole Timche has tile works. This section is surrounded by old wooden windows and old bricks. This part of the bazaar has astonishing architecture. Most of the carpet selling stores are in this Timche. Here we have the copper market, one of the attractive sections of the bazaar, in my opinion. Yes, the familiar sound of hammers on copper. I may buy these cooking wares. Oh, very beautiful. Good souvenirs. Well, art is long and time is short. Of course, the traditional bazaar of Kashan is more than what I described for you, but I have to come back to Tehran before night. In the future, I may come back here to see the details of this astonishing bazaar of beautiful Iran. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Afghanistan has accused Pakistan of providing airspace for U.S. drones to enter the country. It has called it a clear invasion by the Americans of Afghanistan and its airspace. If this is true, what gains will this have for the U.S.? And why would Pakistan allow this to happen? What is in it for them? This is while these comments come less than a month after U.S. President Joe Biden claims the killing of al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone strike in Kabul, while also marking 1 year since the drone killing of 9 members of a family that were mistaken for Daesh terrorists. First, let's talk to Abdullah Amirzadeh, correspondent over in Kabul, to get the latest on these statements. Abdullah Amirzadeh, at this point, we know what Afghanistan has said regarding these drone operations by the U.S. illegally in the country. Tell us more about their reaction to this, and, of course, if we've heard anything from Pakistan as of yet.
Well, yes. As of yet, the Pakistani officials have not said anything yet on this matter. As our condolences with them, they are dealing with the flood thing. They have not said anything yet on this matter. But the experts are giving their opinions. They say now with the drones in Afghanistan's airspace, people have the right to be scared. As a truth, you can hear the drones right now flying on the space of Kabul. The experts say, as we remember, as people remember, 1 year ago, a drone strike took the lives of 10 members of one family. The Americans say at first that they thought it was an ISIS shelter, ISIS house, but it turned out to be a relief worker, an aid worker's house, killing 7 children and 3 adults. And also, the experts are saying now that this is highly probable that the drones attack to some aims or maybe actually target people, target houses, as we witnessed almost a month ago. The U.S. drones aimed a house, targeted a house, and as they say, they killed the leader of al-Qaeda, which is yet exactly unknown. The Taliban are saying that they were not aware of the attack. The United States did not give them actually any information before their attack. And they also say that they do not know if there was any member of al-Qaeda hiding in that house. As of now, we only know that the Pakistani officials have not said anything on this matter. And this is almost the whole information that we have yet. We must wait more to see what the response of the side of Pakistani is.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Abdullah Amirzadeh. We appreciate it. That's the correspondent there from Kabul.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of the program. John Stuffer joins us. He's the director of the Foreign Policy and Focus from Northampton, Massachusetts. Also joining us on the phone is James DeCross, former U.S. diplomat, who joins us from Virginia. Welcome to you both. John Pfeffer, let me first start with you. We're looking at an accusation that Afghanistan has leveled against Pakistan and in turn the U.S. in a sense of the fact that Pakistan has allowed the U.S. to use its airspace and in turn fly into Afghanistan's airspace with its drones and to conduct airstrikes. So the first question is, why would Pakistan allow that? What is its gain? And also then the U.S. goals from doing this?
Well, Pakistan has had a relationship with the United States. It's, of course, been up and down over the years, depending on who's in charge in Washington and who's in charge in Pakistan. But, of course, you know, there has been significant economic assistance that has gone to Pakistan, occasionally security assistance. So Pakistan gains something from the relationship with the United States. The United States, meanwhile, when it withdrew its troops a year ago from Afghanistan, it said it would maintain an over-the-horizon presence. In other words, it would continue to be involved in Afghanistan with the assistance of other countries in the region. The most logical country, of course, would be Pakistan. And so it's not such a surprise, perhaps, that Pakistan would align itself with the United States on this particular maneuver. And of course, you know, from time to time, Pakistanis have had their disagreements with the Taliban, both the Taliban on the ground and the Taliban in power. And so it is to the advantage of the Pakistanis, I suppose, to keep the Taliban guessing. Perhaps it goes without saying that the Pakistanis are not thrilled, of course, about some of the more extreme factions on the ground in Afghanistan, including Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
James Atras, so what is your impression of the way that Pakistan has cooperated with the U.S. in terms of allowing it to have drones fly into Afghanistan? Again, what gain does Pakistan have from this? And, of course, what kind of use will the U.S. have? Is this short-term, or is this going to be a one-off, or is it going to be continuous?
Well, I think I agree generally with what the previous speaker said, and I think this is part of what we need to address with the United States finds itself globally, not only after the Afghanistan mission, Ukraine, and also the current confrontation with China. But I think Washington is pressing around what can, where it can gain them using drones like Somalia, government in April, where it appears earlier that Pakistan was trying to maybe broaden the perspective that we now have so long with whatever Washington wants. Okay, what in Afghanistan, having after more than 2 years. Well, if we can't control the place, at least we can disrupt it. And I think this project for our holding money that had been allocated for development, and as we know, this has led to a lot of hardship.
Okay, we're going to try to actually get a reestablished line with you again, James Dutras. It was kind of hard to decipher what you were saying. John Pfeffer, however, let me come to you now. We're looking at another incident that involved a drone strike by the U.S. president in which Joe Biden announced the killing of the al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri, and this happened in a drone strike in Kabul. Now, what's really strange about this, which the Taliban have expressed, and in response to the drone strike, what the U.S. has said, and that is the Taliban says it's not sure if Zawahiri was killed, and the U.S. has said he has been killed. We're not going to provide any evidence. No DNA. The case is closed. Why would the U.S. Present that in such a form and manner? And what do you think? Do you think Zawahiri was killed?
Well, those are tough questions. I mean, I obviously don't have any inside information as to whether Zawahiri was or was not killed. I think the United States, of course, doesn't have a presence on the ground in Afghanistan. It is thus very difficult for the United States to provide kind of forensic evidence to prove that Zawahiri was in fact killed by the drone strike. Obviously, the United States was tracking his movements for many months. They proved in some sense that they didn't need intelligence on the ground, or at least they haven't admitted that there's any intelligence on the ground, which was one of the major criticisms of the Biden administration's withdrawal 1 year ago. In other words, critics said, how can you possibly ensure that the United States will prevent the rise of or the strengthening of al-Qaeda and ISIS, Khorasan, in Afghanistan? And the United States, in some sense, is using this drone strike as a rebuttal, as saying, look, we in fact don't need the intelligence on the ground. We have plenty of tactics at our disposal, plenty of surveillance, and we have used it to kill the leader of al-Qaeda. Now, it also should be pointed out that Zawahiri is probably not the most, shall we say, active of leaders on the ground. I mean, he's an old man, or was an old man, quite sick, probably didn't have, you know, a great deal of operational control over al-Qaeda, but nevertheless was kind of important as a symbol. So, you know, in some sense, what the Biden administration has said is we've killed this symbol. As for producing the body, that's less important. What's more important is that we killed this symbolic leader. We don't have to actually provide any greater proof of that. If you can demonstrate that we didn't, in other words, if you can produce a live body of Zawahiri, then go ahead and do so. Until you do so, we have declared our mission successful.
Taking a look at the fact that you have these drone strikes that have happened, and of course it was something that happened quite often at some points during the 20-year occupation, are we looking at an increase at U.S. drone operations? As you just said, many within Washington actually criticized Joe Biden for the way, not only for the way that the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan, but for the fact that they are very unsure about how much of a danger either we call them Daesh terrorists, you called it IS Khorasan, in Afghanistan is going to play against U.S.'s national security as time goes by. So is this part of a trend now of U.S. counterterrorism activity, as they would like to call it?
Well, that's a good question. And again, it's difficult to say because, in fact, over the last year, there hasn't been a lot of drone activity, especially in comparison to the Obama years. Donald Trump, of course, was very enamored of drone strikes and also made it more difficult to know the extent of the U.S. drone war by making U.S. drone activities far more secretive. When Biden came into office, he actually ordered a review of drone policy. In some sense, to make it more transparent, also to get a sense of, you know, what the extent of drone activities are and whether they were necessary in various theaters of operation. When it comes to Afghanistan, to be honest, I think a great deal will depend on what's going on inside Afghanistan. Not so much U.S. Counterterrorism strategy, as you pointed out, in part because the United States is really focused on other things right now. It's obviously focused on Ukraine and providing Ukraine with military assistance, very focused on China, containing China, and doing an uptick in military maneuvers in East Asia, particularly around Taiwan, and resuming, along with South Korea, military maneuvers there. Afghanistan, to be entirely honest with you, has really decreased in its priority in U.S. strategy right now. We don't have troops on the ground. There is no allied government in Kabul that, you know, we have to provide assistance to. And, you know, as the last your other speaker said, the main focus is really around the delivery of Afghan funds that have been held in U.S. banks, and whether, you know, the United States will deliver that money back to Afghanistan. I mean, it's Afghanistan's money. It's just, you know, the United States has been dragging its feet, shall we say, in terms of returning that money. And in an important legal case, there has been an effort to turn at least half of that money over to 9/11, September 11th survivors. So there's a lot of controversy around that money. But that's where the emphasis is right now, frankly. And unless there's a real uptick in activity of, as you said, Daesh or of Al-Qaeda, and when I say uptick in activity, I really mean uptick in activity outside the borders of Afghanistan. I don't think the United States cares that much about the internal politics inside Afghanistan. And as I'm sure your listeners know, there's considerable disagreements, shall we say, or considerable conflicts between the Taliban and Daesh and Al-Qaeda and there are other, of course, even conflicts within the Pashtun community inside Afghanistan. So I think, you know, all of that is, you know, internal questions that the United States, frankly, no longer cares that much about unless it spills over the borders of Afghanistan.
Well, the whole issue with the funds is a big deal, and it is quite the focus of what seems to be the U.S. focus at this point as to what to do here. And I'm very curious as to why the funds have not been returned. Many are questioning that within Afghanistan. But the question comes about is what are the reasons for the U.S. not to do this? They have put into focus mm-hmm. women's rights. That's been something that they have said time and again as to the reasons why. And also maybe a little bit of, not a little bit, but maybe a degree of mistrust when it comes to the recognition of Taliban, which the U.S. really has not done, and what the funds are going to, where are they going to go? But when you're looking at a country that's suffering the way that it is with the humanitarian situation, that is probably one of the worst now in the world, women's rights doesn't quite rank on top of the list here. People's lives should rank, unless there are other motives, because this is now happening in a country where it's very unstable, given the economic situation. Why do you think it is that the U.S. is dragging its feet when it comes to these funds?
Well, you know, I think you answered your own question very effectively. I think the United States is very skeptical about the Taliban as an authority, as a government. It has suspected that any money, whether it's, you know, Afghan money or international community money or humanitarian aid from agencies, that money will not go toward their intended recipients. The United States fears that the Taliban government will take any money that it receives and either spend it on something else, guns, so forth, or it will disappear in corruption. And of course, you know, the United States unfortunately has a very bad record over 20 years, even when it was, you know, theoretically leading anti-corruption efforts inside Afghanistan, of seeing U.S. aid disappear into the hands of those who were not the intended recipients.
All right. Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate your comments. John Pfeffer there, Director of the Foreign Policy and Focus, is talking to us there from Northampton, Massachusetts. Unfortunately, James Dutross, former U.S. diplomat from Virginia, we could not reestablish a connection with him. We do apologize for that. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavitagwe, and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio is a guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Hujjatul Islam Academy. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Karimi, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, today we want to talk about the concept of Al-Aza Al-Husayniyah. As in Urdu they say, Aza Ki Husayni, or in Farsi they say, Azadari. Also in English, roughly, it can be translated as the mourning ceremony, MOURNING. Ceremonies or processions held for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. The Shia community, brother Karimi, Sheikh Karimi, is accused of having innovations regarding azadari for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and holding, and say there was no such thing in Islam or Quran beforehand. Now, for today's discussion, we want to see whether azadari or mourning processions has any Quranic roots or not in the religion of Islam. I mean, can we bring Quranic proofs for doing azadari for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam as the most famous one and all the other infallible ones?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The first point that I would like to share is that because usually this question is asked by the Wahhabis, and they claim that, as you mentioned, this azadari is a kind of innovation in the negative sense of the word, is a bid'ah, and people should be away from that. And one of the reasons is that it is not mentioned in the Quran. Now, the first question is that, is it necessary for all the permitted or recommended actions to be mentioned, even the obligatory actions to be mentioned in the Quran? Of course not. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the Quran, we find some general guidelines and instructions, and more details, we need to refer to the narrations. So when it comes to mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, if you remember in one of the previous episodes, we talked about the fact that the Holy Prophet himself, according to Sunni sources, he has mourned for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So, for example, when it comes to the prayers which are obligatory, the daily prayers, do we find any verse in the Quran talking about the details of the prayers, like to say the morning prayer in 2 rak'ah and the Zohr prayer in 4 rak'ah? We cannot find the details of these even obligatory acts mentioned in the Quran. We need to refer to the narrations.
Yes.
So we shouldn't think that we find a very explicit verse talking about all the details of the religion, the obligatory rules and the recommended rules, and so on and so forth.
Yes.
This is the first point. So we find many narrations in this regard, yes, both in Shia sources and Sunni sources.
Also, the prophetic lifestyle of Prophet Muhammad had shown that he himself shed tears a lot, for example, on Ibrahim, his son, on Hamza, his uncle, on the martyrs of Uhud, you know, and the other battles. Yeah. You know, he himself cried and shed tears a lot.
That's a kind of azadari.
I mean, not in the group form or in the collective form, but personally.
We have it in collective form. Okay, like, as you rightly mentioned, when Hamza was martyred, the women in the city of Medina were crying, collectively, in a group.
Yes.
And the Holy Prophet says that, وَلَكِنْ حَمْزَ لَا بَوَاكِ اللَّهِ. No person is crying for Hamza. And it is documented in even Sunni sources that for many years, for any person who passed away, first of all, people cried for Hamza,
yes,
and then cried for the diseased one. So, which means that the Holy Prophet confirmed the action of these women.
Yes.
They were crying for the martyrs of Uhud in a group. I mean, collectively speaking.
Yes, yes. And the title Sayyid al-Shuhada before Imam al-Hussein was given to Hamza.
Exactly.
And this is really okay, nice for today's discussion. Okay.
So, this is one point that this is, a wrong expectation to claim that everything should be mentioned explicitly in the Quran. Okay. Now, this second point is that, implicitly speaking, the concept of mourning can be confirmed by the verses of the Quran. Okay. There are some verses in the Quran, as I mentioned, in many cases, the Quran is giving us just general rulings and principles. Now, let me share some of the verses of the Quran which refer to the concept of mourning, at least implicitly. We have one explicit verse. Let me share that before going to the implicit verses. And that is the grief of Ya'qub, Prophet Jacob, for losing his son, Joseph, alayhi as-salam. This is mentioned explicitly in the notebook of Quran, and this is a kind of azadari, this is a kind of mourning. It's been mentioned that we know the story of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, that when his brothers took him and they threw him in the well, and then Prophet Yaqub alayhi salam cried for Yusuf alayhi salam, profusely for many years, according to some narrations. The Quran says, chapter Yusuf, verse 84, Ya Asafa ala Yusuf, he was very grieved about Yusuf. Wabiyattad aynahu min al-huz, his eyes had turned white with griefs. And fahuwa kadhim, and he choked with suppressed agony. Now, we are talking about a great prophet because of the fact that he has lost his son Yusuf. And of course, he's not dead. He is still alive.
Yes.
But he is mourning just for losing him. And in the same chapter, we read, the brothers of Yusuf came to their father and said, Tallahi tafta'u tathkuru Yusuf. By Allah, you will go, takuna haradan aw takuna min al-halikin. By Allah, you will go on remembering Joseph until you wreck your health or perish.
That's right.
And according to some, for example, Zamakhshari, one of the great Sunni scholars of tafsir interpretation of the Quran, he says that he cried for Joseph for 70 years. And interestingly, we have one narration in Shia sources that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam was, somehow questioned by the people that why you are crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He said that, do you not know about the grief of Yaqub? He cried for losing Yusuf alayhi salam to the extent that his eyes turned white.
Yes.
And that was while his son was alive. Just he disappeared from him. He didn't know where he was.
That's right.
But for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, I saw that my father and 17 people from my family, they all were martyred before me. So how is it logical for Yaqub alayhi salam to cry for Yusuf alayhi salam and not for me to cry